everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Cinephiles Live here on the Cinephiles YouTube channel. This is our monthly live show that we do here on the channel in lieu of an episode breaking down in movies. And today we are going to be talking about the legacy, the history, the artistic footprint, the films, the art, the music, all the stuff that encapsulates the late, great David Lynch, who passed away in January, just a few days ago here in 2025. I am John Rocha, one of the co-hosts here of the Cinephiles, joined as always by my co-host, Steve Morris, film director, writer, producer, and co-host of the podcast. How are you, Steve? How are things?
I don't know. Things seem real weird for me right now. I've been spending a lot of time with a bunch of movies that I don't know, either I'm discovering the secret of the universe or I've just gone entirely insane. It's definitely one or the other. I'm not sure which one.
And what do you mean by that? Do you mean you've been catching up on the David Lynch oeuvre, shall we say, and trying to get a little more knowledge on his stuff?
That is exactly what I've been doing. Yeah. I have watched several films, and we'll obviously discuss them as we go through his career.
Yeah.
And he's a hard one for me to reckon with. We'll just start right there. It's tough. Yeah.
Even after having spent extended time with him, you still find yourself a little bit kind of trying to figure out where you stand on him and his work. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Well, and I would also say, I don't think David Lynch wants you to watch one of his movies and go, oh yeah, I got it. Yeah, totally cool.
Yeah.
You know, that is not what he's, you know, it's like if you watch Airplane, you fully understand what Airplane was. If you watch Enter the Dragon, you get, like, I understand what the filmmakers are trying to do. I get it.
Right.
If you watch, you know, Eraserhead, you go, huh. At least that's what I do. So yes, I'm going to wrestle with him. And obviously, you and I both have feelings about David Lynch, and yes, they're different from our feelings from some of the other great directors. And we're going to get into all of that as we go through this.
Absolutely. That's kind of the goal of this particular episode here live. And also, this is inspired by a lot of people who reached out to us or DM'd us or sent us messages on social media, basically saying to us that you guys need to do a David Lynch film. But, you know, we also need to respect who we are and be honest with ourselves. And we are not the biggest David Lynch fans of his movie. And I don't mean that we don't appreciate the work. I just mean that we're not naturally drawn to it. So doing one of his films isn't necessarily something that we wanted to do in response to his passing, because there's a lot of, you know, who listen or watch our show. We do tributes and we'll do, you know, recorded intros, or we'll move schedule around to put in a film that is from someone who's recently passed away. But in this situation, we just felt the live show was a more authentic way to do this, because Steve and I could speak about our feelings about David Lynch, but we can hear from some of you all who are much more hardcore David Lynch fans and why he affects you, why his movies touch you or inspire you as an artist, or what is it about his work that you enjoy? Or some of you may come in and also say, well, I never got him. I just couldn't quite put my finger on why I never quite became a David Lynch fan. So all the spectrum of emotions and reactions can happen here in this particular episode. So we thought a live show was the best way to do it. But before we dive in, Steve, we should tease that we've got some announcements coming up later on in the show. What do you got for
us? Oh, John, you know how I love to tease things. Well, what I'll say is that February is going to be a huge month for the Cinephiles. We have new plans that are built off some of the things that we've done in the past, but we are taking them to a greater and higher level that's going to involve, hopefully, the entire Cinephiles community. And I'm not going to say what it is, but it may or may not have something to do with an important event that is coming our way. That's all I want to say at this moment. But I'm really, really excited about our plans.
Yeah, there's a lot that we're going to be talking about. We hammered out some of the stuff yesterday, even after our advisory board meeting. For those who don't know about this, we have a very great Patreon that a lot of people are a part of. We have some fun conversations with them. In fact, we'll have some comments from our patron members throughout the show here in terms of their connections or feelings about David Lynch. But yesterday we had a wonderful advisory board meeting with our patrons who are at the $25 and above level. And we have meetings with them every month. And we sit down and we talk about what our plans are for the upcoming future, what their thoughts are. If there's something that Steve and I are stuck on in the show, they are a great sounding board and they offer some great direction or great opinions, great input to explore. And if not, it's sometimes something they say, we may not agree with it, but it may spark something else that kind of untangles a wire that we have as we're looking forward to doing more and more things and expanding the reach and the scope of the Cinephiles. And yesterday was another example of a wonderful conversation talking about David Lynch with them as kind of a preview for what we're going to do today.
Couldn't agree more. It was great talking to them. And in particular, it's great. And this is something, and I'll just go right to, we put out on Patreon, sometimes on Patreon, we ask for questions from our patrons that we will use in shows. And I will say our greatest Cinephile short suggester, who is actually, I believe, in the audience right now, Ryan Lieb, sent us, I'm going to say, Ryan, this was an epic series of questions. We're not going to get to all of them. Mm. But one of them that he wrote, he says, this is just Regency bias or the algorithm. But since his passing, I have been flooded with positive statements and memories about him more than I can really remember for any other celebrity. It has been incredibly moving, in particular the words that came from actors like Laura Dern, Kyle MacLachlan, Naomi Watts have had to say about him. Can you think of other notable people in the film industry who have been remembered this way? And I just think that's what we saw as well. Like both you and I had this moment of going, we don't really know how to do a David Lynch film on the Cinephiles. We don't really know that we're the really people to talk to. And then from the Patreon community, from the general community of the Cinephiles on social media, we got an overwhelming statement from so many people who it was important to. You guys have to talk about David Lynch. And I think that's a big part of why we're here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, for sure. And we're looking forward to seeing if we do David Lynch justice. And of course, you guys who are watching us live will certainly let us know what your feelings are about it. And of course, those of you who may be listening later will send us messages and let us know what we should have hit on or what we missed, or maybe you appreciated the way we handle things here in exploring David Lynch. So, and stay tuned a little bit later for those announcements. It's going to be a lot of fun to let you guys know what we're planning, and it's something really big. So it's not like one of those things where you hear people go, we got a big announcement and it's, oh, we're moving to Tuesdays. This is something much more than that. And so just take our word for it. You want to stick around for that. And of course, for those of you maybe watching, we will have time codes for it. So maybe you'll skip to that if you want. If you're impatient and you can't wait to hear our announcements, you'll swing back to the David Lynch conversation. So, but Steve, let's talk about this. You know, the show, we always ask, you know, how did you come to film? I guess I should start off the bat here by asking you, how did you come to David Lynch, this incredibly interesting filmmaker who really has left a hell of a footprint with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 films and 4 TV shows, one of which is The Biggest Note, which is Twin Peaks. But what an incredible footprint and impression he has left. So what was your first interaction with David Lynch? When did you hear about him? And what was the first movie you watched?
I'm going to say that I came to David Lynch 3 times. So, and the reason I say it this way is that I didn't really understand. I didn't really come to David Lynch until number 3. Mm-hmm. So number 1, I saw The Elephant Man, loved it, thought it was an amazing movie, and went, oh, wow, didn't hear the name David Lynch. I was probably 12 or 13 when I saw it. Mm-hmm. I was very moved by it. It was very powerful. It was a really good movie. Then as a science fiction person, I saw Dune. I had read the books. I was super excited. And then I saw Dune. Still didn't really. I wasn't a cinephile then. I didn't look at the names of directors. I was just like, here's Dune. And it was kind of okay. You know, it was interesting. And Sting was in this weird little bikini outfit. Dune was Dune. And then, so that's twice. I've now seen 2 David Lynch movies without really knowing the name David Lynch. Although I think Elephant Man is a beautiful, beautiful film. Yes. And then I'm in my dorm room or in my dorm at Bowles Hall at Berkeley my freshman year. And I'm in the lounge and someone says, dude, we got to watch this movie. And they put on Blue Velvet. And Blue Velvet is where I discovered David Lynch. Okay. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like for me, that's where I went, what the hell is this? Who made this movie? This is this guy named David Lynch. And then of course I went back and the next thing I watched was Eraserhead. And now I was like, and then I went back and watched Elephant Man. And then I went back and watched Dune. And then I was like, okay, what the fuck is this? This is a completely different thing.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah, I think I might have this a little bit of the same path in terms of the beginning, because I remember seeing Elephant Man when I was a young person. But it was a movie that affected me very deeply. It emotionally messed me up because of the performance. And that scene, you know, I am a man, not an animal. You know, if you've, there's something about that scene that spoke to me as a young kid, because when you've been bullied, when you've been beat up, when you've been called names, when you've been kind of persecuted in growing up, that scene can speak to you. That idea of being surrounded by people who see you as an other, who look at you as something ugly, or look at you as something that's not like as cool as them or as great as them or as good looking as them, it can affect you. And so I just remember that moment staying with me, even as a young kid who'd been bullied. That scene, watching that scene, just kind of destroyed me. And the performance, it was the beginning of my love of Anthony Hopkins, which started with 1978 or 79's Magic, the one where he's the with the ventriloquist doll. And so those were the beginnings. So I had no idea who David Lynch was. I just knew the movie, right? I knew John Hurt because of Aliens, but I didn't know who David Lynch was. So I wouldn't say that I came to David Lynch in that movie. I just know that I like that movie, and it's a movie like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest that I can only see every once in a while, because it is a devastatingly tough movie to watch, all with a beautiful message, by the way, even though it ends in a little bit of tragedy. But it wasn't too, but and Dune, I was like, fine, it was okay. It wasn't for me. It wasn't till Wild at Heart. That's when I really came to David Lynch. When he released that in 1990, I remember renting that. Maybe next, the later that, or next year, I guess 1991, the year after, I rented it and watched it. And I was just immediately transfixed by that movie, for Nicolas Cage, for Laura Dern, the madness of the film and everything that it showed. And so for me, that's when I got into it. I wasn't a Twin Peaks person, although I enjoyed Julie Cruz as a singer in that Falling song. It just never quite grabbed me, but it was Wild at Heart that eventually got me across the line. Then I saw his other films after that, Blue Velvet. I've never seen Eraserhead, nor do I imagine that I will. Lost Highway, I couldn't finish an hour into it. Love Straight Story. Mulholland Drive is interesting, but didn't quite grab me the way it did other people. And The Inland Empire is an experiment, but I think once was enough for me. So, yeah, it's really Wild at Heart that is, and Straight Story, that are the two that stick out to me, with Elephant Man as well.
For me, I feel like, this is such a weird one for us. There's never been a filmmaker that you and I have felt reluctant to talk about. This is the first time. And I think part of it, and this has changed, by the way, because I watched one movie I had never seen, which had I watched it before, I would have said that we could have easily done that on the Cinephiles. But and we'll get to that when we get there. But but like, part of it is going like, well, what do we have to say? You know, when we're going to do a deep dive into a film and spend a week or two or 3 weeks really digging into it, It has to be our movie. It has to be a movie that we feel we can really talk about. And this is the thing that I realized about me. And I have two stories. I'm going to tell them very quickly, but they're really related to why I do not feel like I'm the right person to be, you know, leading a deep dive into the world of David Lynch. And this is what it is. So I was in film school and ended up making a film with our friends Matt Garcia and Josh Haber, both of whom you know. Mm-hmm. And it was to be a TV pilot, and Josh had written it, and he had written a Twin Peaks surreal sort of bizarre story set at a university. And Josh was the writer and Matt was the producer and I was the director.
Right.
And I should never have directed this movie. It was totally wrong. It was, you know, and it had all these things. And I kept pushing Josh, because I'm a story guy, going, well, why is this person only visible through cracked mirrors? And why does this shadow follow this person and then disappear? And why, how does this person have total control over the dean of students? And what is the conspiracy behind, like, what's going on? And Josh didn't want to answer. And of course, because he was a David Lynch guy and I wasn't.
Right.
And so even though I did the best job I could directing this thing, it is the worst thing that I have ever made, and also almost ended all three of our friendships. It ended almost ended in each direction. We were all so angry with each other because we shouldn't have been making that movie together. Mm. Flash forward years later, when I'm teaching film school, and I would have a student present their surreal piece to me and say, help me with this. And I'd be like, I can't help you with this because it's not something that I intuitively understand. I intuitively understand story. I intuitively understand like how to put the movie together, what elements you might need for the cut, what sound design might help, styles of music, what, you know, performance, all those things. Yeah. I've always, they're things that they click and make sense to me. But when a student would come to me and say, well, in this moment, I want to have just the image of a frog, and then I want to cut to spilled paint, and then have someone sobbing uncontrollably in a close-up. Do you think that's, or should I do it in the other order? And I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea. I cannot help you. I cannot teach you. I can't. I'm not a person who understands this kind of art in a way that I feel like I could speak as an expert on it. You know,
And
that's where when we were talking about like, well, should we do Wild at Heart or Mulholland Drive's Blue Velvet? I'm like, I don't know that I have that I can talk about why Lynch made the choices that he made or how things are working, because I don't know if I understand it, you know?
Right. I hear you. And looking at it on the other side, it would have been a fascinating challenge for us to explore a film like this and kind of dive into it and see what we take from it. Because as you said, I don't think David wants you to see his film the first time and get it all the way through. And even in a discussion of ours, that would just be our feeling about the film at that time. And 10 years later, we might have a completely different episode of The Cinephiles on that particular movie. And I think that's why... Like you, I think you're in a roundabout way, you stumble into why David Lynch endures in the way that he does, because his films stay with you. When you finally see any of his films, if any of them attach themselves to you, they stay with you for a long time. I mean, the way he plays with these motifs, these dreamlike sequences throughout most of his films, the way he addresses some of the grotesque physicalities and what have you, the body horror of Eraserhead, or what you see in the design of the Elephant Man, even though in the end we do appreciate and value the beauty inside of who he is, you can't deny that the look is meant to have an effect. It is designed to have an effect on the viewer initially, and we see that throughout. You know, even Dennis Hopper, who's not disfigured in any way, but him grabbing that mask and screaming so deeply into it, in a way he is disfiguring himself in that reaction. And so, and we do see moments of violence, and so there is stuff like that throughout his movie. Even Robert Blake's look, the white with the stark appearance that he has in Lost Highway with the hair slick back, all of that is meant to affect you as you watch his films. But it may affect you one way in your 20s versus your 40s and 50s. And I think that's one of the reasons why he endures in the way that he does for so many people who love film, you know. And it's a fascinating thing to explore with him. But I will say this, and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, and you might get offended if I say this. I think we should stop saying that we're the wrong people to do this, because we're doing it. So we're going to do our best with it. We're going to have fun with it. And hopefully people who are Lynchian people will feel respected by it and will understand that we are not the big, like, super knowledgeable on Lynch, but we respect him and honor him enough to want to try to talk about him in a way from our own honest perspectives on David Lynch. So... I want to jump into a little bit of his background, Steve. Is there anything you want to say before we jump into it?
Nope. Go for it. I'm ready.
Let's do it. All right. So David Lynch, let's bring him up here, because I want to make sure you guys can look at his pretty face while we do this. He was born David Keith Lynch in on January 20th of 1946. 1946, right after the war, Steve, World War II. He's been called a visionary. He was acclaimed for his films because they were distinguished by their surrealistic and experimental qualities. His career spanned more than five decades. He won the Golden Lion for Lifetime Achievement at the Venice Film Festival in 2006. He got an Honorary Academy Award 2019. By the way, he was nominated for four Academy Awards, including three times for Best Picture for Elephant Man. Sorry, three times for Best Director for Elephant Man, Mulholland Drive, and Blue Velvet, and then nominated for Adapted Screenplay for Elephant Man. His romantic crime drama, Wild at Heart, the one I love, received the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival as well. His Twin Peaks series, he received five Primetime Emmy Award nominations, including Outstanding Director and Outstanding Writer for that series. And it's a fascinating series for a lot of people, for sure. And also, another thing that's interesting about him is that he also did painting. He studied to be a painter initially before finding his way into filmmaking. He also wrote a number of books. He wrote an autobiography, I think that came out in 2011, that people can explore and read, but also did voiceover work on The Cleveland Show, which some of you may not know. Yes, The Cleveland Show, the animated Cleveland Show. He had a great, interesting arc in Louie, and then recently, of course, playing John Ford in The Fablemans, which was a film that Steven Spielberg released recently that I think was nominated for Best Picture as well. And another element of him is that he was a massive practitioner of transcendental meditation. He started his own a foundation to implement transcendental meditation, to promote it. He taught veterans. The foundation taught veterans, taught people who wanted to learn. There was a whole plan to do an $8 billion program that would spread transcendental meditation all over the world. And he did that every day. He said twice a day, 29 minutes each time he would do it. And he never missed a day or worked his ass off not to miss a day. So fascinating stuff about this guy. He grew up in the Midwest. He did go around from different places and moved around because of his father's occupation. And he said he didn't have any trouble making friends. No matter what new city he went to, he had no trouble making friends. But he was always attracted to the cracks in suburbia, the cracks in suburban life. You would look at an awesome tree and see the sap rolling down. I would look at the bugs or the ants that were licking on the sap and go even deeper. So he was drawn from a young age to explore what was going on underneath the facade or the presentation of what you see initially, and see maybe the darker underbelly of it all. But I think also Straight Story is an interesting indication of the kind of desire he had for companionship, for friendship, for love, how he understood no matter how much of the darkness he shows you, in the end, it's because people have been abused and wanted love that you see the themes and the motifs that go on throughout his movie. So it's a fascinating thing to explore him.
I really like that we're starting here just with his life, because I think there's things about his background that are 100% irrevocably linked to his filmmaking. Yeah. And one of them is just, you can't separate the America of the 50s that he grew up with.
Yes, yes.
From his films. Yep. You see it in Blue Velvet, you see it in Wild at Heart, you see it in Mulholland Drive, you see it in so many of his films. And I think in the Straight Story of like the Midwest, the Americana, that sense of the what it is to be part of the United States of America is so particularly post-war America. And that vision of the America is always contrasted with the underbelly and the surreal and the strange. Mm-hmm. But you got to start with that vision. The second thing about it is that he really is an artist. And I don't mean that I'm saying there are all sorts of directors who are artists. Obviously, directors are great artists. Yeah. But he is, in terms of personality, he is a painter. He is an arty person. He sees the world as an artist. I watched the documentary David Lynch, The Art of Life. And it was so funny because as it's going on, it's a very arty documentary. And I'm going, can I get some more information and some more details and some more story about how everything happened? It's like, no, which about a half hour. And I'm like, all right, this is ironic. Like, come on, this is obviously the difference between, you know, I want details. And there are lots of shots of him smoking a cigarette and staring off into the distance while or working on his paintings where they're not saying anything. And I'm like, come on. And it's like, well, that's what David Lynch is. And one of the things that came out a lot, and I'll tell you a couple of stories that came out in the documentary that was really interesting, is his fascination with things, you know, with just the world around him. And one of them was he would look at a thing, something that we wouldn't see as necessarily that interesting, or sometimes something that's kind of gross, and he would just become completely obsessed and fascinated with it.
Yeah.
He also, by the way, said that, you know, things that his relationship with his family was really interesting in terms of him and his art, because they didn't get it. And one of the stories he told was that when he was in art school, and he was a painter, he had this basement and he stored a whole bunch of weird stuff that he had found that was like, you know, maybe a dead rat or maybe something that was growing or maybe, and they were in his basement and he was kind of fascinated by looking at them. And his dad came over and he brings his more conservative dad down to the basement, super excited to show him this stuff. And he shows him this stuff and his dad looks at it and David is very excited about all of it. And then they're walking out of the basement and he takes a glance back at his father and sees this look of just horror on his dad's face when his dad wasn't looking. And they come out and he says, so what do you think? And his dad said to him, David, I think it's important that you never have children. And I just think that what's so funny about what's interesting to me about him is that that didn't mess him up. You know what I mean? Right, he was interested in what he was interested in. Mm-hmm. And he was the amount of effort and labor and dedication this guy, you know, whether you're talking about his films or his paintings or everything else, he put everything into what he was doing because he passionately believed in the art he was trying to create. And all of that, I think, comes from this background, growing up in the 50s, in the world he grew up with, and then the world of art that he entered into, you know.
It's a great point. You know, he had a quote about the 1950s. That's one of the motifs going throughout some of his films. He said, it was a fantastic decade in a lot of ways. There was something in the air that is not there anymore at all. It was such a great feeling. And not just because I was a kid, it was a really hopeful time and the things were going up instead of going down. You got the feeling you could do anything. The future was bright. Little did we know, though, that we were laying the groundwork for a disastrous future. So it's a fascinating thing. So just, again, the veneer of the 1950s, and you listen to the 1950s songs, and, you know, it's all doo-wop and hip and all that kind of stuff, and like bubblegum pop and everything, lollipop, all of this from the 1950s. But, of course, what's going on in the 1950s? It's also a decade rampant with racism and how certain people are, and women start to feel like, you know, tied to these husbands, and divorce is not something that is promoted or accepted or liked in these communities. And these communities are starting to branch out and be gated communities. They're judging who can move in and who can move out. So although the veneer is this really clean, upwardly happy place, there's much more going on underneath the surface. And again, that is what you, as I alluded to, and you just alluded to, the idea that he liked and he was drawn to, looking to see what was beneath this, the ugly underbelly that was going on underneath the surface of all of this stuff, you know? And so, and you're right. I think this is the thing about David Lynch that is fascinating when you do a little bit of exploration on him. He is a battering ram of what he's going to do. Yeah. There aren't moments of like, oh, I don't know if I'm ever going to accomplish this. No, he just knew, and things would fall into place for him. And he advanced very quickly. I mean, Eraserhead is coming. I think it was at AFI when he does Eraserhead. And that was done because he had done a short film, got into the Academy, did a like six to eight minute film. And then boom, Eraserhead expanded upon. It was going to be a small film, but his contemporaries there at the AFI thing encouraged him to write more pages, make it longer. And then it became a feature film. And from that feature film, he moved forward and started and got Elephant Man. And from Elephant Man, he was offered Return of the Jedi, and he turned it down and instead went and did Dune for De Laurentiis there, which you would argue is a colossal misstep. But his logic was, you started this trilogy. You should finish this trilogy, George, not me. So we could have had David Lynch's Return of the Jedi. I mean, just think about that, Steve.
It would have been terrible. I just can't imagine. Like that combo, like with Dune, because Dune is weird. You know what I mean? Like some of this, so I can see the fit there. I can't see the fit with Jedi. I think it's so, you said you described him as a battering ram, and I think that's really accurate. And you hearing about the stories of Eraserhead and what it took to make that film, because this is made over many years where they're running out of money. And a lot of it is David Lynch alone sort of puttering as an artist. And and this is what's so, sometimes the battering ram for him is like, how do I get these disgusting little chickens to move and pour blood in exactly the way that I want them to do that? And that's what I'm telling. And I hadn't seen Eraserhead since college, and I'm watching it for the first time. And there's literally a moment like they get to the baby, and I just had to turn off the TV. I'm like, I'm out. I can't handle this right now. I'm done. I have to take a break. It's too much. And I just am going like, what? The mind that comes up with that. And what I love, you know, it becomes sort of this cult movie, and then Mel Brooks goes to see it. And I love that Mel Brooks, after the movie is over, goes up to David Lynch, gives him a big bear hug and says, you're a madman. I love you.
Yeah. Mel Brooks of all people.
Well, and Mel Brooks is the producer of Elephant Man. That's why Elephant Man happens. And I just that whole idea that Mel Brooks is the producer of Elephant Man, and that he picks. I mean, we just did a Mel Brooks produced film, and that was directed by David Cronenberg. That's The Fly. So two of the directors that Mel Brooks picks are David Lynch and David Cronenberg, two out there guys that Mel Brooks supports. I just love that.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I find always fascinating when people want to denigrate certain decades. Like people want to say, 80s, what was going on in the 80s? Well, the 80s were happening, and yes, we had the John Hughes films, and we had the rom-coms, and the dirty sexy, or the dirty teen sex comedies, and whatever. But we also had David Lynch. We also had Cronenberg. We also had this kind of darker edge running at the same time with some of these films that were coming out. You just had to go find them. You had to explore and go find them. And I think those are the directors who are laying the groundwork for the independent film movement. I think a lot of those people like Tarantino and Soderbergh, all those people are watching those films and being inspired by them to find their voices in the 1990s and make their films, Steve.
I absolutely think that's true. And I also think, and this is, you know, I'll say it again and again, is there needs to be a place for people to make weird shit that other people don't understand, or people to get into offensive, difficult areas that make people uncomfortable. And you don't have to like it. You can go, you know, it's funny. We had my mom joined us for the advisory board meeting yesterday and mentioned going to see Blue Velvet. And I think she, in her very delicate way, said that pushed me. That was difficult for me. And it's like, yeah, sometimes it is. Sometimes you're going to go, that is not to my taste, but that's okay, because that inspires other people in other ways to make other art that is great, you know?
Yeah.
This message is to the gentlemen of the cinephiles. Now, some of you, when your car breaks down, you might take it to a mechanic without hesitation. But when the problem is something a little bit more personal, like ED, a lot of men out there feel a little bit hesitant to seek help. Thankfully, through Hims, you can get access to personalized ED treatment without stepping outside your door.
Yeah, Steve, Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing you with access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. The process is 100% online, so there's no need for uncomfortable doctor's visits, no insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care.
Start your free online visit today at hims.com/cinephiles. That's hims.com/cinephiles. For your personalized ED treatment options, hims.com/cinephiles.
The products mentioned are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
John, did you know that your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? I mean, it's not just about your birthday. Your body could be a little bit older, could be a little bit younger than what you think. And that's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part, it's all done from the comfort of your home. No prescriptions, no lab visits. It's just a simple test sent right to your door.
Yeah, Steve, that's why I was so excited when True Diagnostics said they wanted to come on and sponsor us here on The Cinephiles. You know, you and me both talk about our health, and certainly people listening to us, they're very aware of their health as they get a little bit older, and you want to kind of stop things from coming or be more aware of what might be coming. And True Diagnostic has a thing called True Age Test. And in that True Age Test, you can find out so much about the age of your body, which helps you. So I was very excited when I got my True Age Test recently from True Diagnostic.
And the cool part is, this is not guesswork. The True Age Test is based on peer-reviewed research from scientists working at Harvard, Duke, and Yale. I mean, this is real science that you can trust. So think about what it would be like to know exactly how your lifestyle is impacting your body. True Diagnostic makes it easy to get started, offering simple, actionable insights that you can use right away. This is your chance to take control of your health and get the bigger picture. Don't leave it to chance. True Diagnostic helps you understand not just where you're at now, but where you're headed.
All great points, Steve. All right, Cinephiles fans, are you ready to find out your biological age? Right now, our listeners can get 20% off their entire order at TrueDiagnostic.com by using the code CINEPHILES at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic, TrueDiagnostic.com. Just use the code CINEPHILES to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today.
Yeah, and certainly Lynch fits into that category. And I think that's why so many people had wonderful comments to make about him afterwards, who were inspired by him. You know, I mentioned the Cleveland show. The reason he is on the Cleveland show is because the guy who created the show saw, I think, Wild at Heart or Blue Velvet, and said it changed his life completely as an artist. And so he wanted to pay it back by asking David Lynch to be a character on the show, the recurring bartender on the show. So like, there's these little things. You just don't know who you're going to inspire and what direction they're going to go in. It doesn't mean they'll go in the same direction as you, but it'll be something about it that sparks them to find their own voice to create the things that they create. And that's the true legacy of a great artist, is all the tentacles that appear from their work in the many places that the people they inspired create work because of the stuff that they did before. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve. One more. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to jump to Blue Velvet if that was all right with you. So again, watching this documentary, he told two stories that I think really connected to Blue Velvet. One is that as a very little kid, he was out on the streets playing as you do. And all of a sudden a naked woman came walking down the street looking extremely distressed.
Ooh.
And sat down, and it was with his older brother. And I think he was little. I think he's like 8 years old.
Right.
And he said, described her as like looking like a giant, and that she was, I think, sobbing, and they didn't know what to do, and they didn't know how to help her, and they didn't know how to cover her. And then he says he blacked out. He doesn't have any memory of what happened next. Cause this is a very, very young memory. That's the first story.
Yeah.
Second story, he's in Philadelphia, where he had gone to multiple art schools, and the one he finally, you know, the one in Philadelphia was the one that he really loved, and he's surrounded by all these artist friends.
Yes.
And he describes living in Philly as living among the crazies. And he says, even though I lived in fear, it was good for me. It was thrilling to live the art life in Philadelphia at that time. And I think that there's so much of what Blue Velvet is in those kinds of experiences, because you start with the just pristine 1950s world, and then you see the underbelly of that world and the journey into the darkness. And what's so key, because I rewatched Blue Velvet, what's so key to Blue Velvet for me is there's a thrill in going to the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
It is dangerous, and it is scary, and it is sexy, and it is interesting, and it is compelling. And there is that journey is one that it's just what David Lynch is talking about in his journey as an artist, is that it's scary and it's thrilling, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he talks about living in Philadelphia. He got married in Philadelphia. They bought a house in Philadelphia in one of the areas that wasn't that, shall we say, upwardly mobile. They bought a house for $3,500. It was in kind of a dirty crime area, seedy area. And he said, the house got broken into within the first 2 weeks they were there. They got robbed twice while they were living there. She had a baby while they were living there. And they eventually got divorced during the Eraserhead production. But his wife was Peggy Reevey. They had a daughter, Jennifer Lynch, who became a film director herself. But he talks about that, as you said, the quote you said, he talks about to describe the feeling of living on the edge in Philadelphia, both artistically, but also that feeling when he would go home and we'd have to go through the seedier areas to get to his house, the fear and the danger he would experience from that situation. And I guess when you're young, you know, that's a thing that you find in some way exciting, as you said, Steve. So I think that's an element as well of what how it influences him overall, his work and his personal life throughout, that he was willing to put himself in these situations to risk things because he wanted to do what he wanted to do, you know, and I think that bears it out. And you're right about, I mean, you talk about Blue Velvet. I mean, that was in his head since 1973. Like, that's how long that had been kind of germinating until it finally came to be. And it's a fascinating film. Tell me, when you watched it again, what stood out to you? What did you feel, the things that connected to you before were just as strong, or was it different things that connected to you? What was it like watching it a second time in prep for our conversation here?
That's a great question, because I think it was very different, because when I saw it the first time, I was 18 and I had come from my suburbs, and I was in I'm at the lounge in the college dorm watching this with a bunch of guys, and I was pretty naive. I mean, I was pretty sheltered kid in a lot of ways. And so the experience of watching it then was very much the experience of Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern's characters of, we're sheltered suburban kids, you know, who are then brought into the world of crazy.
Yeah.
Watching it today, I've been to the world of crazy. You know what I mean? Like, I've been around a lot more stuff. And in particular, you know, the world of the artist, you know, most of the time when your friends are all actors and writers and artists and stuff, yeah, they can't afford to live in nice locations. They're living in some loft across the tracks where there are people doing, yep, drugs on the street and stuff, yep, like that. So I spent after that 18 and growing up, I spent a lot of time in kind of areas that were a little bit dingier or where there was a little more scary stuff going on. And so in that sense, it was less of the veneer of 50s Americana above the underbelly of crime and stuff like that, because I don't believe in that veneer quite as much as I did, you know, back then. But yeah, it was much more, I was much more drawn to the Isabella Rossellini character, yeah, who was amazing in the film, and just the complexity of pain and loss and fear and desire and desperation and being trapped and all of those things and those choices that she makes, which as an 18-year-old, I was like, why is this woman doing these things? This is terrible. Like, why are you doing this? To, as a grown-up going, yeah, people are fucking crazy. And they, when they're in terrible situations, people do all sorts of things because that is what they need to do at that moment. So I'd say my reaction was very different.
Yeah, Roger Ebert, when the film came out, was one of the critics who really didn't like what happened to Isabella Rossellini's character. His is quote, he said, Rossellini is, quote, asked to do things in this film that require real nerve. She is degraded, slapped around, humiliated, and undressed in front of the camera. But Rossellini has always defended the film. And by the way, she had a relationship with David Lynch for 5 years. She said, quote, I was an adult. I was 31 or 32. I chose to play the character. I think my character was the first time we did an abused woman, a portrait of an abused woman, but also she camouflaged herself behind what she was asked to be, which was sexy and beautiful and singing, and she obeys the order and is also victimized by it. That's the complexity of Blue Velvet, but also the great talent of David Lynch. I thought he did a fantastic film. I love Blue Velvet. So yeah, there have been people, and I remember even back then, people were complaining, some of the critics, because their critics were much more vociferous in their desire to destroy films than they are nowadays. And a lot of people,
I'm not going to agree with you on that, but okay. Well,
fine. I find the critics back then were much more intelligent and vociferous in their destruction than nowadays. That
I might agree with.
Okay, fair. But so when they came for you with some pretty biting criticisms. And certainly Isabella Rossellini has pushed back on that consistently throughout her career about Blue Velvet, because people didn't like that that Lynch was showing this kind of stuff, right? Like you said, Steve, some people have a hard time with watching things that make them uncomfortable. And as you mentioned with your mom, that film really pushed her. And I think this was the intention of David Lynch. He was trying to show people, and I don't think in an overt way to be like, I'm going to wake you people up. It was more like, I'm going to do this film because this is what I'm drawn to do. And I'm showing you, if you're willing to see, what's actually going on beneath the surface and how terrible and depraved human beings can be. And by the way, the film is not full of people who are depraved and terrible. I mean, Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern, they're the heroes of the movie. So you see that there are other things going on, and she's a woman that's caught in this psychological cycle of abuse. She's constantly raped by Dennis Hopper. He's kidnapped her husband and their kid. And so she is stuck in this moment. How does a woman with no power function in a situation like this to try to find some power and navigate through it and survive in order to get out of the situation? And you talk about this naked woman. We talk about suburbia. How many women, how many mothers did David Lynch know who were stuck in loveless marriages growing up in suburbia? And in essence, were in their own cage having sex with husbands they didn't want to have sex with. How many of those husbands were raping them on the regular because I'm the man, I'm your husband, I take what I want? That's the mindset from some of those guys back then. I don't say predominant because I wouldn't know, but like certainly we hear about that. And so this is maybe an emblem, a symbol of that, or symbolic of that, which I think is an interesting way to look at the film and explore the film as well.
You know, it's funny. I started this by saying why I shouldn't be a David Lynch. You know, I shouldn't make that kind of movie. And it's like, if I were making a movie about this abused woman and this kid who's kind of investigating, and this bad guy, yeah, the Dennis Hopper character, I would know what I was trying to say. And yeah, at the end, so would you if I made that movie.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's not what David Lynch is trying to do. I don't even think I can say that David Lynch was trying to say something. You know what I mean? I think, or at least in the way I would use that term, it means, yeah, that if I say the thing I'm trying to say, like if you watch The Assistants, it's not that the message is 100% clear, but you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And at the end, you could probably say, I think this was what Steve was trying to say. You know what I mean? Whereas David Lynch, that's not how he operates. He doesn't want a wide swath of agreement at the end about what the movie meant. He wants people to be talking about what the movie meant and arguing and being disagreeing. Or I don't even know. I don't even want to put that much into his mouth because I don't really know that that's the case. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Because they find an ear, right? That's how they start the whole thing is the ear, right? Oh,
yeah. So absolutely.
To me, I look at it because, you know, I look at things symbolically. It's like, he wants you to listen. He wants you to hear what he's trying to say in this movie about abused women in our society, you know, especially the women he grew up with. And someone said this in the comment section here. Ryan Charles. Yeah, Ryan Leap. He says, hey, he had a thing about, quote, a woman in trouble. Yeah, for sure. I mean, we saw that throughout his movies. Absolutely. By the way, Pauline, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, no, you finish. And then I got a question from one of our patrons.
Pauline Kael praised Lynch after this movie because this movie, Blue Velvet, won the National Society of Film Critics Award for Best Film. Pauline Kael praised Lynch as a, quote, genius naif. I hope I'm saying that right. I don't know that word. And said that he might turn out to be the first populist surrealist. She described him as a Frank Capra of dream logic. And she quoted a moviegoer as saying, maybe I'm sick, but I want to see that movie again after coming out of Blue Velvet.
Wow.
Fascinating. Yeah.
What a great review. So this is another question from one of our patrons. And again, patreon.com/thecinephiles. And it's a great way to get your voice heard in some of these episodes.
Yeah.
This is from Bose Fam, who says, lots of people talk about the darkness in Lynch's work, and that's certainly warranted. But I wish more folks would talk about the hope evident in so much of his work. In Lynch's story, there is real power in love, forgiveness, friendship, and even the simple goodness of coffee and donuts. As Sandy says in Blue Velvet, there's trouble till the robins come, but the robins do come. What do you think about that, John?
I think that's a great point. And that's the time, sometimes you can get caught, some, you know, how can we say this? There are film people who are snobby about their love of movies. There is film snobbery, right? And especially those ones who claim to be more intelligent about film and they grab onto things like David Lynch, directors like David Lynch, and they'll hold them as champions of he's exposing the truth you don't want to hear. He's blah, blah, blah. But they don't want to give him credit for also defaulting all the way back to what you see in all the Disney films. This feeling of hope, this feeling of being able to overcome these things. Look at Straight Story. I mean, Straight Story is as non-lynching a film as you can see, if you want to use that adjective, but there's it's still surreal in its own way in how he's telling the story of the brothers and healing. But at the end, it's about healing and repairing and forgiveness. And I think throughout all the movies all end with this feeling of hope for sure, that it can be different, that you can fix things, that a happy ending is possible, right? And so that is the stuff that gets lost. And especially when you listen to some film snobs and film people who get a little arrogant about their analysis of films, like they want to wash over that rather than actually give it its due because they want to focus on more of the darker stuff because they think it's cool, as opposed to actually understanding what he's trying to say. And I think that Robin's line is a great, great example of that because they do always come in his movies. Even in Twin Peaks, they came in. Twin Peaks is about, I think, the darkest thing he's ever made, and the Robins still come.
So I'm debating whether or not I want to talk about Straight Story and I want to talk about Twin Peaks. Which one do you want to start with?
Twin Peaks is next chronologically, so let's get into this thing. Go ahead.
I remember when I was in college, Twin Peaks started happening. I think I was a senior because it was just like 90, 91, something like that.
Yes. Yeah. 90.
And I remember people started talking about it, you know, and we didn't have streaming. We didn't have DVRs. You had to get home and tape stuff. And there was someone who had taped the first four episodes. It was like, you guys had to come over. And so it was a whole bunch of theater kids all in this person's house watching this thing.
Sorry.
And there was so much fun in the weirdness, I would say, you know, watching scenes where people are, you know, speaking backwards and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And but in the end for me, and this is maybe where I kind of split out of David Lynch, was like, I need a story. Like in the end, and you know what? And I'll tell you here, I have a very strange theory for you, which is I do not think that there is the TV show Lost without Twin Peaks.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of shows that don't happen without Twin Peaks. Great point, Steve. Yeah.
And I think, and this is the thing, is that the movement of Lost is one that I really don't like. I love the first season of Lost. I don't want to turn this into a discussion of Lost, but my thing about Lost was I remember having this moment in the second season where they kept every week they're introducing another weird thing. And I went, oh, they don't know what they're doing. This doesn't mean anything. We're never going to get to an answer of all this stuff. And I'm a person who needs, and I don't need an answer, but I need the filmmakers to, you know, like it all to fit together in a certain way. And Twin Peaks is the first time I had the experience where I was like, okay, this is all really neat. This is all really interesting and weird, but I don't know what's here. I don't get it. And so that's sort of where I start to pull away from David Lynch. You know,
I think that's fair, but I also think there was from doing the research here, there was a lot of stuff that went on behind the scenes.
Oh yeah.
That kind of caused that situation to occur with Twin Peaks because it's ABC, right? And it's ABC, it's primetime. It's one of the broadcast networks, right? So they initially liked the idea of Twin Peaks because certainly this is what the beginning of the film, the independent film movement, people's tastes are changing. You want more of the realism mixed in with the fantastical in some of the content. And so here comes Twin Peaks, and it is gangbusters in the first season. What is it? It said Lynch directed two of the first season's seven episodes. He carefully chose the other episodes' directions. He appeared in the show to kind of keep himself close to the whole thing as FBI agent Gordon Cole. And the first season was a success with high ratings in the U.S. and in many other countries. But the second season of 22 episodes went into production. ABC executives believed that the public interest in the show was declining, so they insisted that Lynch and Frost reveal Laura's killer, the identity of Laura's killer, prematurely, which Lynch begrudgingly agreed to do, and he called it one of his biggest professional regrets because he had a different story and pace that he wanted to tell, but ABC was like forcing them to do this thing. And then they moved the show to Saturday, and it was canceled after a ratings dropped. Lynch said he disliked the direction that writers and directors took in the later episodes, and he came back to direct the final episode, and he ended it with a cliffhanger like season one, but saying that's not the ending, that's the ending that people were stuck with. So he clearly wasn't happy with how the second season went about as well. So maybe what you're complaining about would have been solved, or you're offering a criticism about, would have been solved if David Lynch had been allowed to do the season he wanted to do. So it's an interesting situation when you look at that, because I mean, doing 22 episodes back then, I think Twin Peaks nowadays would have been 10 episodes each, and Lynch would have been allowed a lot of leeway to create the show he wanted to create, because obviously now studios like HBO, they're much more open to letting creators create their stuff when it comes to shows like Twin Peaks, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, it makes way more sense in the streaming world today.
Yes.
It is so insane to me that ABC put that on the air.
I know. That's crazy. Still kind of crazy for sure. But after Twin Peaks, you know, of course, later on, there is a movie that's a prequel back going back and forth in time. And then there was a return for a third season. I think it was on Showtime. I think that was only 10 to 15 episodes. Didn't have quite the same feeling, and some of the actors didn't want to come back for it. Some of the actors did, some of the actors didn't. So it wasn't quite, I think, what he was hoping to do with that. But the same year the Twin Peaks comes out, Wild at Heart wins the Palme d'Or at Cannes. What's your feelings about Wild at Heart here, Steve? An interesting film with Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, and dare I say, one of the most outlandish, if you can even say that about Nicolas Cage performances. I would say it's one of the most outlandish outlandish performances for sure.
So here's my experience. I had two entirely different experiences.
Yeah.
Number one, I saw it with friends, one of whom was a huge Nick Cage fan. And we had watched, you know, Vampire's Kiss and crazy early Nick Cage things.
Great stuff.
And we watched it, bunch of guys, and it was hilarious. And we laughed all the way through the movie. We're like, this is so awesome. And then I went and watched it with some other people and said, you're going to love this movie. It's hilarious. And it was just me, not the Nick Cage fans, kind of different group of people. And it was the saddest, most depressing movie I'd ever seen. And it was the first time, I don't know if you ever had this experience where it's like, oh, the people that you're with totally can dictate what the tone of a film is, a movie like Wild at Heart, where it's not like anything else.
Yeah.
So how you interpret what you're seeing, whether it's crazy and hilarious or scary and sad is totally dependent upon your position going into it, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And that's what I mean. I think that's the movie that appealed to me first, because like at 16, I wasn't ready for Blue Velvet. I just wasn't ready for Blue Velvet. But in 1990, when I'm, you know, coming into my 20s, I'm ready for Wild at Heart. I'm ready for what he's trying to show me on that screen. And I would say that Wild at Heart influences Natural Born Killers for all of his film. I mean, I feel like that's kind of in the same wheelhouse when you look at that movie and you look at the connection that Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern have in that movie. I mean, they're so strong and sexy and powerful. It's dangerous. It's bloody. Diane Ladd is like borderline insane in that movie, and what she's like.
Not borderline.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think she's over the border.
what she's asked to do, you know, it's so fascinating. And you know, actors like that, I'm sure, get really excited. You know, Diane had years of work through the 70s. She'd been in and seen some pretty interesting stuff from auteurs in the 70s. So I'm sure, you know, seeing someone like David Lynch, who probably hearkened to those auteurs in the 70s and wanting to play and wanting to dive into a character like this. And by the way, that role gave her a whole new life in the 1990s as a character actress in demand. So, I mean, like, there's a lot that you can take from that film for her. I also think Laura Dern, people forget. I love that people think of Laura Dern for Jurassic Park. And it's like Laura has made her bones doing independent films, made her bones doing these kind of dangerous films that explored topics and explored stuff that hadn't been seen from a lot of actresses before. And I appreciate that about Laura Dern. So when she shows up in stuff like Star Wars, it's always nice. But it's the other stuff where she's much more, where you really see the talent of Laura Dern. And I think David Lynch understood that and why he used her so much. And Kyle MacLachlan as well. It's funny, people don't talk about Lynch and MacLachlan the way they talk about DiCaprio and Scorsese or De Niro and Scorsese, but he used MacLachlan a lot. And yet people don't necessarily bring those two up in conversation. It's always a fascinating thing for me.
I'm very curious about what the experience of working with David Lynch is, because my guess is they really like him. You know, the actors that have worked with him more than once.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, like Laura Dern. Yes, she's a young actor at the time that she started with him, but it's sort of, she's down to like go on that adventure. Isabella Rossellini was down to go with that adventure. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think he appeals to the artistic instincts of actors, no matter what their gender are. And certain actors, not everyone, right? Not everyone would be willing to be in a David Lynch film. Laura Dern was. Laura was called to those kinds of roles from the beginning of her work. Yeah. And of course, being the daughter of Bruce Dern and what he has some interesting tastes for roles as well. So I'm sure all of that kind of factored into the situation there as well. So the film, what's it? The film was based on Wild at Heart, the story of Sailor and Lula, about two lovers on a road trip. Lynch departed from the novel, though, in the movie, making these numerous Wizard of Oz references. Again, the idea of the illusion and the mask and who's behind, you know, the wizard, that kind of stuff. But as I said, it did win the Palme d'Or, but it was booed at the Cannes Film Festival when it won. And one of the people booing was Roger Ebert, who admitted it on The Late Show with David Letterman that he had been booing it as well. So it's certainly a divisive film, but it's one that I thoroughly loved. So,
the description I remember hearing, and I feel like this came from Lynch, but I have no idea, was that the description is it's Elvis and Marilyn on the road to hell.
Yes. Which is probably not so much.
Yeah. Of course.
All right. Do you want to move on? Did you see Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me? Do we need to?
I did not.
Okay. So I don't know if we can say much about that film other than he approached it from a place of wanting to go back to this. He said, I like the idea of the story going back and forth in time. Of course, that film, for those of you who watched it, it deals with the last few days of Laura Palmer's life and was much darker in tone than the TV series, with much of the humor removed, and dealt with such topics as incest and murder. Lynch said it's a film about, quote, the loneliness, shame, guilt, confusion, and devastation of the victim of incest. So pretty dark stuff there throughout. And as I said, some of the series came back, some of the series actors came back, some of them didn't. They refused to, and the film in the end was a commercial failure. But there has been a critical reappraisal of the film, and even Mark Kermode, who is a well-known critic, has called it, quote, Lynch's masterpiece. So
okay.
After this, though, Steve, we get into some weird stuff because he does a show called On
The previous Air. Stuff had not been weird?
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of, like, he goes into these interesting directions that aren't really that well received. Like, he does a comedy series called On The Air in 1992, which was canceled after three episodes. Then he does a three-episode series called Hotel Room on HBO. It doesn't do so well. But then he starts to do, like, music stuff. He starts to move into doing music videos. He works with a Japanese artist. And then in 1997, Lost Highway appears, which was co-written by Barry Gifford with Bill Pullman and Patricia Arquette. And as I said, Robert Blake earlier. And that film was kind of a commercial failure and received a mixed response from the critics. So at this point, you start to wonder if maybe Lynch has lost it. Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me didn't do well. These two series weren't that well received. And then Lost Highway isn't that well received. But then here comes Straight Story, which is a film that was created from a script by Mary Sweeney and Johnny Roach. It's based on the true story of Alvin Straight. That's who Richard Farnsworth plays in the film, an elderly man from Lawrence, Iowa, who goes on a 300-mile journey to visit his sick brother, played by Harry Dean Stanton, by riding a lawnmower. And Lynch said that the reason he chose the script is because that's what I fell in love with next. Nothing bigger than that. And he described Straight, Alvin Straight, the Richard Farnsworth character, as, quote, like James Dean, except he's old. And that's why I approached the film the way that I did. And it's a G-rated film, Steve, from David Lynch. And it's one of the most beloved films in his entire repertoire of movies. Your thoughts on Straight Story, buddy?
So this was the one I had never seen that I watched last week. And this, of course, is the one where I said, well, we could easily do this on the Cinephiles. I know how to talk about Straight Story. I understand what he's doing and how he's doing it. And it really moved me. I mean, I cried at least three times, maybe four in the course of the film. Farnsworth is fantastic. All the performances are great. And it's like you took this 50s Americana artist who is always interested in the surreal and the underbelly and the different and the dangerous and all that stuff. And you pulled all the darkness away and you just said, let's look at these people that he grew up with, this World War II generation, and what they feel and how they're dealing with this trauma and family values and all this stuff. And it just was so simple and so honest and so perfectly crafted. And this is why it's like, and it's funny, one of the other questions from Ryan, who I know is listening, which I'm not going to bring up the whole question, but was really about the, you know, like our tastes and art versus craft. And I think for me, like my definition is craft is the thing that you use to produce your art, you know? And so I don't always, you know, some of Lynch's art isn't to my taste.
Right.
But his craftsmanship is undeniable. And so in the case of Straight Story, you see him using his craft to very much tell a very straight story, a very simple, easy story. And you see, like, oh, the same tenacity, bullheadedness, the way he, as you described, that he's barging forward to create his art. Mm-hmm. Now he's using it for this purpose. And man, it works so well for me.
Yeah. Janet Maslin of the New York Times said, quote, somehow it took David Lynch to lead audiences past the ultimate frontier into a G-rated parable of spirituality and decency seen from the unfashionable vantage point of old age. He accomplished the unthinkable by putting Richard Farnsworth in a devastatingly real and rock solid performance on a lawnmower at 5 miles per hour and still building enough drama and emotion for a great chase. Burned out on the surreal and the grotesque, Mr. Lynch faced down inevitable realities about aging and conscience. So I like that as a description of the film. And by the way, this was a film that was distributed by Walt Disney. Peter Schneider, who was the studio president at the time, saw it at Cannes and immediately bought the distribution rights for the movie. So Disney in business with David Lynch. Who would have thought that in 1990 to see it all those years later now for Straight Story? It's pretty surprising.
I love it. And I just, it's something I say, there's so much of this industry that tries to go like, oh, you're a science fiction person. Oh, you're a comedy person. Yeah. Oh, you do this kind of thing. It's like, no, artists are craftsmen, and we actually are capable of applying that craftsmanship to a bunch of different stuff. And David Lynch was no exception.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Straight Story is, I think it's probably my second favorite film of his. And there's so much about it, and I've spoken about it for years. Like, I saw it just randomly, because again, as we said, I wasn't the biggest David Lynch guy overall. And so when I saw this and it was like two old guys, I love films about old people that are like good, well made. And so I was like, I'm going to watch this thing. And I fell in love with it, immediately fell in love with it, and always recommend it to people to watch. So I'm very happy you watched it and enjoyed it. And I hope anyone who's listening or watching us now who hasn't seen it gives it a chance and is not like, oh, it's G-rated, it's not going to be that interesting. It's actually quite interesting and very moving, especially for those who might be getting older, or some of you old rebels who might be getting older. There's something in that film for you, I think, as well. All right, so then we move into this period in the 2000s where he does Mulholland Drive. Some of you may not know this, but this was originally supposed to be another relationship with him and ABC for a series. This was supposed to be a 2-hour pilot for the series Mulholland Drive, but there were disputes with ABC executives, who could have seen that coming, over content and running time, which is what led the project to be shelved indefinitely. But Lynch was able to get $7 million from production company Studio Canal there in France, and he completed the pilot as a film. It's a non-linear surrealist tale of Hollywood's dark side with Naomi Watts, Laura Herring, and Justin Theroux. It did well at the box office, was a critical success. As I mentioned, it got Lynch a Best Director nomination. He was also he won Best Director at Cannes in 2001 and Best Director from the New York Film Critics Association. By the way, he tied for the one at Cannes with Joel Coen for The Man Who Wasn't There, another damn good film of the Coen brothers. We will be chronically the Coen brothers in a little bit this year for our season of. So this film, Steve, was named the best film of the 21st century in a BBC poll of 177 film critics from 36 countries. I am shocked that this film was named that. I will never agree with that, but it's an interesting film. So what are your thoughts on Mulholland Drive? Haven't seen it recently.
So it's very recently. It's like a few hours ago. So yes, it's very recent. Those film critics are wrong. Let's start with that statement. I agree with that. Here's the thing. So I'm watching the movie, and it was slow, and I was frustrated with it. And the opening, by the way, I think is fantastic.
Yes.
The opening, which is the car crash, I think is really great, incredibly stressful. And I'm watching along. I'm going, what the hell is this? And then I see this woman. This is the strongest emotional reaction I had in the entire movie. Because I saw this woman's like, who is that? Man, she looks like Ann Miller. And then I went, holy shit, that's Ann Miller. And that, the joy of realizing that Ann Miller, I had assumed that she had died years before and that she was showing up in this David Lynch movie, made me so happy. And then the movie, it's weird. And it's just like, this is where I didn't love much of the craftsmanship, where the camera was placed. And part of it is, as you said, it was made for TV. And so, you know, and there's some of the performances, there's a thing that happens. And this is where you get into this weird area where a performance from an actor or some dialogue, I can go, that's bad. That's just not good. It is stiff. It doesn't feel real. It is exactly what bad acting or bad writing or the combination of bad acting and bad writing look like.
Yeah.
But people who know they're watching a weird movie go, no, it's supposed to be like that. It's just weird. And I'm kind of like, no, this is bad. This is not. And I had that feeling multiple times watching Mulholland Drive. Yeah. There are scenes in it that are really interesting. And frankly, it was, strangely enough, where it was weirdest was where I kind of liked it the most.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the scene in the diner that's scary where they go out to the alley and we don't know what's going on. And this thing appears. I was like, oh, that totally worked. Yeah. Some of the, you know, when you go to the weird club in the middle of the Silencio or whatever, some of that stuff I thought was very, very interesting. But then there was stunning where I'm just kind of like, oh, what is this? I mean, this is just, you know, a bunch of weird stuff. And then it got to the end, and I won't spoil the end for anybody, but the end genuinely made me go, I have to think about what this means. And that thought in my brain, and then my brain started interpreting, what could this ending mean? It could mean this. It could be symbolic of the veneer of Hollywood, and that Hollywood looks so beautiful on the surface, and then, but it has no memory, and it forgets who you are, and then people are changing identities. And I was thinking about all that stuff, and I was going, motherfucker. But this is, again, I'm going to say both, A, maybe that is why David Lynch is a great filmmaker, because I did have that moment at the end, but B, the long periods of time during which I was bored or didn't feel that the acting was good, for me, doesn't make up for that. The ending doesn't help all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't forgive the bad acting, and I don't forgive like the stiff dialogue or the strange camera placements or the long, slow scenes that take just way too long in my mind. I don't forgive it, but I did have an experience at the end that I couldn't have had if I hadn't gone through all the other stuff. I don't know. Right.
Well, what's fascinating too is that David Lynch he always refused to clear up the meaning of the movie or what's actually going on in the film, because a lot of people obviously have many theories of what that film is about because of all the dream sequences, right? And all the the two main actresses playing two different roles throughout the film. What's real? What's a dream role? What is the truth in all of this? And yeah, the Hollywood underbelly, all this stuff. I felt that when I was watching Mulholland Drive, I feel sometimes like he's showing off a little bit to be weird, as opposed to his earlier offerings, which were weird with some base and some foundation to it. I found at times that it's a little off-putting on purpose, as opposed to off-putting organically in the story that he's telling. So I have issues with that film, and I just don't love it the way other people do. I really don't. I think it's at times pretentious, and not in a good way. I don't mind pretentious if you're forcing me to look at something, right? Like you're doing it in a really good way. I didn't feel that way when I was watching the movie. I was like, he's showing off, being weird and whatever. And it doesn't work for me. And I agree with you. Laura Herring, not the strongest actress. This is a breakout role for Naomi Watts. So this is what kind of announced her.
Yeah.
And she's great in the film. But yeah, I loved Ann Miller. Oh my God. I had such a fun time with Ann playing a role like this, because I bet she never has played a role like this and had so much fun with it. Kind of like Diane Ladd.
My guess is that Anne was a hoot back in the day, and you totally want to hang out with Anne Miller. I'm sure she was a game dame, is how I would put it. She sounds awesome. We have another question from a patron. This is from Robert Dennis.
Okay.
He says, I would love to hear your input on how Lynch's sound design was such a huge part of what made his film special, and how it helped accentuate the surreal images and made them even more off-putting from Elephant Man, the first Lynch film I watched, onward. I always noticed the soundscapes that were infused in his films.
Mm.
What do you think, John, about the sound design?
Well, I think that's a question for you, bud. You're more in tune with sound on these on films, and so I think that's a question to you, and I'll answer after you do.
I think this is a great point from Robert. This is the sound design is huge. It's from Eraserhead on. It is such a part of how you're feeling. Like when you're in Blue Velvet, when you're moving in on the ear, and there's just this soundscape that is uncomfortable and dark. I mean, there's so many things. Or the sound in Blue Velvet of Dennis Hopper with the ether or whatever the hell he's sucking on with that stuff. I'm sure it's not ether because he would just fall down. But but there's so much, and all the way up to Mulholland Drive. And sound is so subjective in terms of its direct ability to affect you emotionally. And you don't. And the thing is, and this is why people don't talk about it, is that you don't always notice the sound design. You can remember the visual, but actually the visual is, you know, the sound is 50% of your movie. It's just only 10% of what we talk about, you know.
Yeah, and I think with David Lynch films, because of the approach to what he wants to show you, this kind of like dreamlike sequences, or the what's real, what's not real, like when we're a bit unsettled, sounds come into our mind, right? Little things trigger, or we hear things, or we remember certain sounds, or we see something and a sound is triggered in our mind. And so in a way, he is taking us on not just a visual journey, but an oral journey in discovering what he's trying to show us. And this working on us in a subconscious level with the sound here. And by the way, he used the same guy here, Alan Splett, from Eraserhead on. He used him in The Elephant Man, used him in Dune, Blue Velvet. What else was it? That was probably the last with Blue Velvet was the last he'd used Alan Sullivan. Alan Sullivan also won an Academy Award for sound mixing for Never Cry Wolf. And so this is a guy who really kind of honed his craft and understood what David Lynch wanted to do. And I think it's a huge part of why his sound design became what it became. And then someone stepped in after Blue Velvet to the sound design for his subsequent movies. But like clearly understood what David Lynch was trying to go for here. And you hear the sounds throughout the movies, the music that pops in, the little grunts and things of that nature. Wind is a sound that's used with David Lynch at times in certain movies. You hear these hisses or these hums that are supposed to throw you off.
And then, of course, occasionally insects, right? We get bees.
Oh, sure.
Spiders making certain sounds. So it's all meant to just keep you unstable or unsettled so that you are experiencing this with all of your senses, his movies. And I think that's how it is in dreams, isn't it? That we're like, we can't control what's happening.
Sure.
But things are coming into our minds and in a way that affects us as we watch a movie of his.
You, I know, were talking to me, which I haven't seen, these little videos that David Lynch was doing. You were describing them to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he started doing these in the 2000s. He started doing some movies here. He even had his own website where he had web series on the website where people could go and watch. They were just put on YouTube, I think, four or five years ago, they were put on YouTube for people to watch. So if there's stuff... If there's those older things that, the most recent things that he did, if you guys want to watch them, they are on YouTube. He did a weather report series for a while where every morning he would get up early, check the weather report, and you could watch David Lynch give you the weather. And so it was a way of kind of staying in people's minds and staying out there for people to see him working and whatever. And so those are fascinating. But I know there's but one of the things that struck me most recently is I saw him do this Netflix movie where he interrogates a monkey as like a detective and he's asking him questions and this monkey has supposedly committed a crime. And so it's a fascinating thing to watch the actor David Lynch in a black and white kind of French 1950s energy or vibe interrogating a monkey about a crime that has happened. So the fact that he was willing to put himself into these really interesting places and doing these interesting works, I think, speaks volumes about David Lynch, the artist. He was always wanting to create, right? Even when the movies maybe weren't happening in quite the same way, because Inland Empire was the last one that was pretty long. It wasn't that well received. I mean, he was sitting out. I remember him sitting out on, I was in LA at the time. I remember him sitting out. You could drive past David Lynch sitting out on the corner next to a cow, a dummy of a cow with a sign for Inland Empire to get people to watch the movie. That's where he was at. But as he was becoming a little bit more of a homebody, he started creating things from the house and doing a website, doing all this stuff and wanting people to watch his work that way. So I like that he still wanted to create all the way through to the final days of his life, you know?
Let me ask you this question, because I was just thinking about it. When you obviously were in a theater program, I was in a theater program. Did you do a lot of surrealism, like just, you know, doing Beckett or Ionesco or those kinds of guys?
No, I wasn't really drawn to it. But like, I liked the stuff like mask work. I was a big fan of that kind of stuff. Modern dance. Even and of course, Thrancing, Steve, as you well know.
I do remember the Thrancing, of course. Yes.
So I do at times find myself drawn to absurdist stuff or avant-garde stuff or maybe even Lynchian stuff. But it's not my natural predilection for me as an artist. But when I do it, I'm always like having fun and enjoying it and where it's going, you know, if it makes sense to me in some level. So, yeah, that's my answer to your question. Why do you ask? Have you done this?
Nope. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. I was in the Berklee Theater Department. They did all sorts of weird stuff. I acted in Ionesco. I acted in this weird biomechanical thing about Eastern Europe. I acted in a thing where for an act, I sat blindfolded and made gestures for maybe 30 minutes on stage. And someone else was speaking Latin and someone else was speaking French or Hebrew. And that was what, you know, it was like. Yeah. And there was, so I think part of my, I was just thinking of, I totally admire and love the artist who goes, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to interrogate a monkey. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do the weather report. They're just following whatever artistic whims and watching his art. Because in the documentary I watch, you see him painting a lot and seeing the intensity and the vision and to create these strange abstract images.
Yeah.
I find fascinating, but I also am like, when I was making those hand gestures in this weird play, I was like, this is fucking stupid. Like, why am I doing this? This is not my thing. And so I am at once, as a supporter and believer in the arts, totally supportive of people following these visions. But as a person who, you know, has my own work, this is not what I do. You know what I mean? Like, I would never occur to me to do it. And most of the time, it wouldn't occur to me to watch it either. You know?
I hear you. Well, I mean, it's the way we all have our different styles. And I think people yep. who... People might be in, you know, look at Disney stuff and be in it and be like, this is the stupidest thing in the world. Why am I doing it? Because they're drawn to darker stuff or more outlandish stuff and, you know, or nonlinear stuff. So it takes different tastes. You know, you just got to get it right. Yep. Certainly David Lynch got it right to leave such a legacy with so many people who left beautiful tributes to him. You know, mentioned Kyle MacLachlan, but like, Nicolas Cage, Laura Dern, Naomi Watts, Ray Wise wrote beautiful tributes to him as well. If you want to read Kyle MacLachlan's, he wrote tributes to him in the New York Times and GQ and his personal Instagram account. The Writers Guild of America announced that MacLachlan would posthumously give Lynch the Laurel Award for Screenwriting Achievement. Spielberg spoke about David Lynch appearing in The Fabelmans and said, "He was one of my heroes, David Lynch playing one of my heroes, John Ford. The world is going to miss such an original and unique voice. His films have already stood the test of time, and they always will." Martin Scorsese said, in part, "He put images on the screen unlike anything that I or anybody else has ever seen. He made everything strange, uncanny, revelatory, and new." And tributes from other people poured in, from Judd Apatow, Mel Brooks, Francis Ford Coppola, James Gunn, Ron Howard, Patton Oswalt, Pedro Pascal, Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins, Questlove, who currently has that Saturday Night Live documentary out on music, Ben Stiller, and critic Peter Bradshaw of The Guardian called Lynch the great American surrealist. And again, Steve, I say to you, 10 movies, 10 movies, and leaving this much of a footprint.
Yep.
There are directors who do 30 movies, 50 movies, Steve, and don't have this much of a footprint. That speaks volumes of the legacy of David Lynch, I think.
I think both in terms of him as a filmmaker and him as a icon, an artist that people admire and are drawn to. And it's funny. I have said multiple things of why this is not my guy. And yeah. I also want to say just as many things of why it's great that we have him and we need more iconic or iconoclastic artists in our world.
For sure.
You know,
for sure. And if there's any legacy on the other side, the physical legacy he leaves people, please don't smoke. I mean, he died from complications from emphysema because he'd been a lifelong smoker. And when the fires happened in L.A., he had inhaled some of that stuff and he died at his daughter's house. So please, people, if you're a smoker, don't do that. You know, because I'm sure there was maybe one more film or one more TV show or one more interrogation of a monkey that we could have gotten from David Lynch if he had stuck around, for God's sakes. Which would have been fun because he's great in the. I didn't like The Fabelmans, but that scene is damn good. So I loved seeing him as an actor because I quietly think he could have been one of our greatest actors as well. Not just the painting, not just the music, not just the film directing. I thought he was damn good as an actor as well. So yeah. A true art. Can you, every sense of the word.
Can you? Yeah. Can you imagine, by the way, going to John Ford and saying and showing him Eraserhead and then saying, "Listen, the guy who made this is going to play you.
Get out of my office." Get out of my office.
Yep.
All right. Do we have any more comments before we get into announcements here? Because I think that's a good one. We talked about him for about an hour and 20 minutes, Steve. So is there any more?
Well, should we do the Streamlabs if the people had specific David Lynch things before we jump into that?
I don't know if anybody sent anything. So 45 of you have been watching us so far, but I see one super chat, but I don't see any Streamlabs. Maybe that's my fault. I should have
pushed. No, there have been a couple.
Okay, good.
Well, I know Wayne Edwards.
Okay. Let me bring them up then. Let's take a look at these real quick. Okay. Yes. Okay, great. Ryan Lieb says, "Just wanted to say I appreciate you guys so much for doing this episode. And despite your reservations about Lynch, you are killing it with the research you have done and stories you are telling. If I can sneak in one more question, Heineken or Pabst Blue Ribbon?" Oh my, PBR or Heineken? Steve?
I mean, I'm not the biggest beer drinker, but I probably would go with the Heineken for me. What about you?
I'd have to go with the Heineken. I can't do PBR, and I can't do the Beast either, Milwaukee's Best. No thanks. So I'd have to go Heineken. I've always enjoyed a Heineken for sure.
There you go.
And Wayne Edwards sends us two, so we'll read them back to back here. He says, I can't say I am a fan of David Lynch. When I was a teenager, I watched Blue Velvet. It was a bit much for me. However, one night on TV, his Dune was being shown. I was taken by how weird it was, and I read the book shortly thereafter. Well, there you go. So I am thankful to David Lynch for exposing me to Frank Herbert. And now as an adult, I dig weird films. Three filmmakers I love and respect now all remind me of Lynch. Nicholas Winding Refn, David Fincher, and Coralie Farget. Yeah, Steve, I think that's an excellent point that Wayne Edwards brings up here, don't you think?
I hadn't thought about the Fincher thing, but actually there's a lot. This is where it would be really interesting, is to be able to have David Fincher and say, was he an influence? Because my guess is he'd say, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And the Coralie Farget thing, certainly, as we see The Substance starting to build in momentum, and certainly people discovering that film more and more as we go into Oscar season. And so, yeah, I think there's definitely a very strong connection, because that is a body horror film. So certainly Eraserhead, The Fly, there's all of that that leads to what we see in The Substance. And Nicholas Winding Refn, absolutely exploring like the darker underbellies of things that are going on under the surface of people's day-to-day interactions and relationships. Certainly there's a lot of that in Nicholas Winding Refn. But I wonder, Wayne, if you could go back now and watch the David Lynch films, now that you're into weird films, would you reappreciate them now in retrospect? I wonder if that's a possibility for you down the road. All right, and then we have a super chat. One super chat from Justin Toner says, hi, John and Steve. I have not seen many of Lynch's films, but I have enjoyed some of them, such as Blue Velvet, which I think is great. Also fond of Dune as well, despite its flaws. He was a unique talent. Yeah.
Agreed, Justin. Agreed.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Justin. Appreciate it. Thanks to everybody who sent in questions here as we go along here, Steve. I think it's we close the book on David Lynch for now in this a live tribute to him, but maybe down the road, as Steve mentioned, we might open the door to doing one of his films, maybe Straight Story, maybe Wild at Heart. I'm certainly, there might be something to explore there. So we will see down the road with David Lynch, but for now, rest in peace to one of the great filmmakers ever, and someone who's influenced so many people going forward that we will be enjoying, I'm sure, for decades to come. So let's move on, Steve, to our announcements. What do you got for us, brother?
Well, as most people who I think probably listening or watching right now know, it is Oscar season in the world of entertainment. And we have covered the best pictures in the last few years, and we have done a sometimes uneven job of getting those reviews done before the actual Oscars aired. This year, we will definitely get all the Oscars reviewed before it airs. But that is not all, because what we have been thinking about a lot is, you know, it's funny, the subject of Siskel and Ebert has come up multiple times. And John, do you remember watching the episodes If We Pick the Oscars?
Oh, I don't know. Oh, I probably did watch those episodes, I'm sure. I just don't distinctly remember them, but yeah.
It became a tradition of the show that they would do their Oscars. Well, that's what the cinephiles are going to do, but we're not going to do it the way Siskel and Ebert. It's not just going to be about what if we pick the Oscars.
Right.
It's going to be what if all the cinephiles picked the Oscars. How would all of you vote? We're not talking about an Oscar pool where you're trying to predict how other people vote. That's not a very cinephiles thing. We're not trying to predict the future or say what other people like. We're going to talk about what we love. And so what we are starting right now is that anyone who is on our Patreon in at any level, including the free tier, that means for no money at all, you can go to patreon.com/thecinephiles and join the free tier. On Monday, we will be releasing our Oscar ballot, which means that all of you will be able to pick your choice for best picture, your choice for best actress, your choice for best score. We'll be able to go through the entire list and make your choice. You'll even be able to write in another choice if you feel that the best movie of the year was snubbed, or the best performance of the year was snubbed, or there was a song that you'd really like to vote for. You can add that song. And on the day before the Oscars, which I believe is Saturday, March 2nd, is that correct?
It would probably be a Sunday, I would imagine, right?
The day before.
Okay, sorry.
Yes. So on the day before the Oscars, we will be right here, possibly wearing beautiful tuxedos, I don't know, and we are going to have our own Oscar ceremony. And on our Oscar ceremony, on the Cinephiles Award, we are going to not just say the winners, but we're actually going to tell you what we've always wanted to know in other Oscar campaigns, which is, what were the percentages? How many votes did everything get? Yeah. What was the second place, the third place? How close was the competition? And because John and I are not required by any laws or statutes to be objective, we're actually going to tell our opinions. So while the things that we wanted to win might not win, you're going to hear our thoughts about it. And that is going to be the very first annual Cinephiles Academy Awards, and you are all going to participate. So again, the big thing is you have to go to patreon.com/thecinephiles, join at any level you want, including our free tier. And on Monday, we're going to release that Oscar poll, and all of you will be able to make your votes.
Right. And so everybody who's already signed up, you're or is already supporting us, or is already part of the free tier, you're already in the mix. It is for the new people who might be discovering us. They will get to sign up and be a part of all of this as well. Am I correct on that, Steve?
That's exactly correct. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. And so March 1st would be when this would happen, because the Oscars are on March 2nd. I just take a look at that. So March 1st, Saturday, that's when we would do this ceremony. And, you know, Steve, it's a great idea. The idea of having everybody be involved in this. I initially thought, well, maybe, certain people should get to vote, but it's like for everybody gets to vote. And it's the best thing, because everybody can have a voice and we can all come together as a community to celebrate these films and talk about these films. And adding that other nomination allows people to write in a film that they love, and we'll mention it on the show. So it will get some love on the show, depending on how we're laying this whole thing out. So look for that for sure. But also, that's not all, Steve. We are going to also be exploring the Oscar films, right? We're going to be talking about them and reviewing them here on the Cinephiles podcast. Is that correct?
That's right. We have it's already in our schedule that it's great. This is going to be a crazy month, because addition to our Cinephile shorts, in addition to a very, very big movie that is going to be starting next week, which I think we should also announce, in addition to that, a watch along where you and I will be watching along Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, that's going to show up on Patreon. In addition to all of those things we're going to be doing, we will be reviewing every one of the 10 Best Picture nominations for the podcast feed, which I have now seen, I think, 7 out of the 10. So we're going to start with the ones that I've seen. And I'm really, really excited to break all of this down. And hey, maybe you and I are going to sway some Oscar voters, for people who are listening, and we'll be able to change some votes. I don't know if you're going to be campaigning as we go, but maybe there'll be a little of that as well.
We'll see. I mean, my awards were last night with the Critics' Choice Awards. Those were where my votes were, but maybe, you never know. Maybe there's an Oscar voter who hasn't voted yet who might be influenced by our conversations. What other announcements do we have to make here, Steve? You mentioned a big film that's coming up and maybe a certain big guest joining us.
The big film is our first movie from the year 2015. And it is also, I said this when we started our conversation, there is an argument to be made that this is the greatest action film ever made. And that is George Miller's Mad Max Fury Road.
That's right. We're doing announcing it. But yeah, that's absolutely what we're going to be doing, Mad Max Fury Road. And we're welcoming back
Brendan McConnell. I thought you were setting me up. I couldn't quite tell, so I went for it. Welcoming back Brendan McDonald, who is the producer of WTF. He joined us for Total Recall over the summer, and he was such a fantastic guest that we knew this was a huge film for him. We have already recorded 2 episodes, and Brendan is fantastic, as we knew he would be, and the conversation has been great.
Yeah, this is we've done 2 parts, as Steve said. It may be a 3-parter, it may be a 4-parter, but that's the park we're dealing with, the scope we're dealing with. This may go 3 parts or 4 parts, but we've already knocked out 2 parts. So we will see how long it actually goes, because we're recording the 3rd part later on this week, and it may finish out the movie, or we maybe leave a little bit more for us to talk about in a 4th part, just to let you guys know with the schedule and all of that. So all right, so Oscars, reviews, and now Brendan McDonald and Mad Max Fury Road. Anything else we need to announce as we're wrapping up this live episode?
You actually mentioned it a little while ago, so I think we might as well make it completely official, which is that when we are done with this crazy month of February and done with our Oscars, we are moving directly into the season of the Coen Brothers on Cinephiles.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. Both of us love the Coen Brothers, Love the films. Can we say what films we're going to be doing a breakdown of? Yeah, please. What do we got?
The films we're doing, and this was a tough call, and this was a lot of discussions with our advisory board, a lot of back and forth between John and I, but I feel like we've landed on two great ones, and that is Miller's Crossing and Fargo.
Yeah, those are the two we're going to explore. And as Steve mentioned, the advisory board, again, I do another plug for the advisory board. Like, if some of you are like, well, why didn't you do this film? Why didn't you do that film? A great way to have your voice heard here on the Cinephiles and determine the direction, or at least have input on the direction of the Cinephiles, is to be part of the advisory board, because we get into those discussions. We ask all their opinions. We debate about it. And then we land where we land by the end of those advisory board meetings on the films that we're going to do in the seasons of, or outside of the seasons of. You could have input by being a part of the advisory board there on the Cinephiles Patreon.
And we even have at least one advisory board member I know making comments in our feed. I will not mention their name in case they want to remain anonymous, but we are very, very grateful for the opinions of this particular board member.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Anything more here as we wrap up, my friend?
No, I think it's going to be a hell of a February. And I really am. Let's just to bring it back to where we started. I'm really glad, despite the fact that this isn't my favorite filmmaker, I'm really, really happy that we took the time to honor the great David Lynch today.
Absolutely. Rest in peace to the great David Lynch. Thanks to everybody who listened to us. Thanks for the Streamlabs and the Super Chats. Thanks for everyone was leaving comments throughout. It was a very lively chat. We appreciate it madly. And thanks to all of you who've listened to this episode, who couldn't join us live. You've listened to this episode. Let us know what your thoughts are on David Lynch. You can email us, or you can DM us, or some of you like to respond to us on Facebook. Like, it's great. Let us hear from you. And those of you who are patron members, definitely let us know on the message boards what you think about David Lynch and what films moved you, affected you. Or if you're not a David Lynch fan, or if you came to him later in life, let us know all your thoughts on David Lynch and how he's affected you, and who you see as artists that are connected to David Lynch as well. Would love to hear what some of y'all's opinions are as well. All right, let's wrap it up there. Steve, what do we normally say to these people as we wrap up here?
Well, we plugged it throughout, of course, patreon.com/thecinephiles. You can join that free tier or any of the tiers in order to vote in the upcoming Oscars or Cinephiles award ceremony. You can also support the show through Apple Podcasts, where you can get ad-free versions of the show or listen to our Cinephile shorts. You can buy or stream every movie we've ever reviewed. And you know what? I'm going to create a webpage for David Lynch, and we'll put some of his movies there. So if there are ones you haven't seen, you can go to cinephiles.net, and there will be a webpage devoted to David Lynch and a bunch of his films. And if you want to reach me, it's SR Morris on Twitter and SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
Yeah, because this is going to come out audio. Just want to remind you all, for those of you who are listening to us, if you hear any of those sponsors during the ad breaks and you want to try out their products, make sure you use our code. That's what's going to keep these sponsors coming back to sponsor our show, is you all supporting us through those codes. So any of those products jump out to you, stand out to you, they feel like you could use it in your life, then please make sure when you use it or reach out to them that you use our code. You'll get the discounts and you'll get to support us here on the show, because those sponsors want to come back and sponsor us as well. And as for following me, you can follow me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Blue Sky. Please remember my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JohnRocaSays. Please subscribe to that as well. New episode just dropped of The Geek Buddies and The Hot Mic for you all to enjoy. Two of the best ones we've done in quite some time. Hope you all take a look at that. And remember to subscribe to our channel on the Cinephiles down below as well. And leave all your comments about David Lynch and what have you. And let's end on the David Lynch's quote here. It's a really good life quote. Some people were sad about his passing, but I think his daughter stepped forward and said, remember this, what David would say, keep your eye on the donut and not on the hole. So focus on what you have, not what you're missing. And I think that's a great way to go forward in life. So take care of yourselves, everybody. From my partner, Steve Morris, I am John Roca, and we'll talk to you next time with another brand new Cinephiles Live here on the Cinephiles YouTube channel.